From PRI, Public Radio International, it's To the Best of Our Knowledge. I'm Jim Fleming. There is a myth that depression is a modern affliction, but Hippocrates and Aristotle described it thousands of years ago. People in the Middle Ages blamed evil spirits for the disease, and in the Renaissance, it was a sure sign of creative genius. There's no doubt that depression has been around for a long time, but why are we seeing more and more of it? Coming up, an emotional roller coaster ride, from blue moods to the underappreciated feeling of elevation. Also battling melancholia, why human beings cry, and the truth about money and happiness.
A windfall of cash generates an enormous amount of happiness and a great boost to your psychological health. So money very clearly does buy happiness.
Just how big a problem is depression? Stephen Hyman, director of the National Institute of Mental Health, puts it into perspective.
There are about 18 million Americans who suffer from major depression. There are about 2.5 million Americans with manic depressive illness. The World Health Organization and the World Bank did a study of causes of disability worldwide, and they found that major depression is the leading cause of disability in the United States and other economically developed countries.
Writer Andrew Solomon is among the millions who suffer from depression. He's written what has been called the definitive book on the disease, The Noonday Demon, which includes a riveting account of his own struggle with mental illness. Solomon told Steve Paulson why depression seems to be on the rise.
I think we live in a more stressful society than we used to. I think that people are sleeping less, and I think we have a chronically underslept society, and that increases rates of depression. I think we live in a society in which not only religious belief, but also the belief in science that for some time took the place of religious belief has been enormously undermined, and that people are lacking a sense of purpose. I think we live in a more crowded world. And I think most of all that we live in a world in which people are increasingly alone. I think the advent of television has caused people to spend more and more time alone. I think more and more of the time we deal with computers and we deal with inhuman circumstances, and that isolation tends to generate a great deal of depression.
Let's talk about stress for a moment, which you have identified as a key factor in depression. What's the biochemical cause here? Why does stress often lead to depression?
Well, when you have high levels of stress, cortisol, which is an essential chemical in the brain, tends to go up. And when you're exposed to a short-term stress, any animal in the wild exposed to a short-term stress has a peak in cortisol, and that peak in cortisol can be very useful for dealing with emergency situations. What I think we as natural creatures are not really well designed for is extended stress, is long-term stress. So we're designed to respond quickly if we're being hunted by an animal and we have to immediately respond to the fact that the predator is after us. We're not designed really to cope with difficult long-term marriages that we're trying to stay in or with employers who we don't get along with very well but have to deal with on an ongoing basis. And if you have a high level of stress on a continuing long-term basis, you break down the stress mechanisms in your brain. You then have got increased levels of the stress hormone in your brain. And once you've got those extended, permanent, increased levels of stress hormone, you never get the stress system back under control properly. And you will always have a messed up emotional system in your brain that will cause you permanent states of depression or permanent disruption of the depression systems in your brain.
In your book, The Noonday Demon, you are very upfront about your own history of depression, and you say that you've had three major breakdowns. Can you tell me about the first one? What brought it on?
Yes. I think I had sort of a medium level of vulnerability, and I had a number of external stressors that really spun out of control. The most immediate one was my mother's death at the end of a long struggle with cancer. But I had also been living with someone for a long time, and our relationship fell apart. And because of those things, I moved from England, where I had been living, back to the United States. And so my social existence was fragmented, and I had an extremely bad round of kidney stones and was in very acute physical pain, and a number of other things happened that were very traumatic. went through all of these things, and then as I was coping with them, I began to feel a kind of emotional nullity, which was extremely odd. I just didn't seem to feel much emotion about anything. And then bit by bit, I began finding things just inexplicably a little bit burdensome. I would get home and listen to the messages on my answering machine, and I would think, gosh, what a lot of people. I guess I should call them all back. And it would all just seem sort of rather effortful and rather weighty. But I thought, well, I'll just get on with things. I don't know why I'm feeling like this, but there it is. And then as time went on, I began to feel a sort of mild sense of fearfulness all the time. And I didn't know quite where it came from. And then I got to the point at which everything began to seem like an overwhelming effort. And I would sort of walk into the bathroom and think I have to put the toothpaste onto my toothbrush and brush all of my teeth. And I think, God, what an effort. And I knew that it was a ridiculous thing to be feeling that way. In the back of my mind, I thought, for heaven's sakes, I brush my teeth all the time. And then it began to escalate, and it got to the point where instead of my finding these things difficult, I began to find them impossible. And I would sort of go in and I would look at my toothbrush and my toothpaste and I would think, I just can't do it today. And eventually I reached the point at which I was finding all of life just intolerably, inexplicably, overwhelmingly difficult and terribly frightening. And finally one day I woke up and I just realized I couldn't get up out of bed. I've in good spirits, I've gone skydiving, and it's much easier for me to jump out of an airplane several thousand feet up in the air than it was at that point for me to sort of put my feet on the floor and get up out of bed. And I thought I'd had a stroke or something. I couldn't imagine what had happened. And I just had this terrible feeling of panic, and I thought, something's gone wrong. I should call someone. But I lay there looking at the telephone and thinking, I have to reach out for the phone and dial the numbers, and I just couldn't do it.
And it's worth pointing out that on the surface, a lot of things were going pretty well in your life. You had just had a novel that had come out to good reviews. You are financially secure. You have a number of close friends. But those things didn't pull you through.
No, and I knew that those things were there. And I kept thinking to myself, that was part of what made it all so bizarre. I kept thinking, I know that I really have a nice life and that I should be enjoying my life and that this doesn't parse. But nonetheless, that was what I was experiencing. I mean, I wasn't even at the level of having emotions about what kind of reviews my novel was getting. I was at the level of thinking, I have to put on both socks. What am I going to do about putting on my socks?
So what did you do then? I mean, obviously, you didn't just lay in bed without talking to anyone for weeks on end. You must have talked to someone.
Well, eventually, when it had got really, really out of control and I was lying in bed that day, fortunately, the telephone rang and it was my father. And he said to me, "Hi, Andrew, how are you?" And I said, "Something has gone terribly wrong. You have to come and get me." And he said, "Why, what is it? What's happened?" And I said, "I really don't know, but I'm really, really unwell." And I knew that I had been feeling emotionally sort of bad and off for a while. I said, I think something's gone off, and I think I'd better go see a psychopharmacologist. And he came down and collected me, and we went to see a psychopharmacologist. And I then moved into his apartment, and it was really as though I were a kind of helpless, not even a five-year-old, as though I were an infant and had to be kind of taken care of. And I went on to antidepressant medication. And within a few weeks, I was able to do some of the basic functioning. But it took really at least 6 months before I was able to do ordinary functional things in an ordinary functional way again.
Have you ever come close to suicide in any of your bouts of depression?
Yes. The funny thing about suicide is that when you're really at the very bottommost pitch of depression and you can't manage to tie your own shoes, it's very difficult to contemplate anything as active and as vigorous as suicide. And I had the experience, which many other people I've talked to have had, of becoming suicidal in the course of recovery. It was when I was beginning to get a little bit better that I suddenly thought, what on earth has happened to me? And I thought, I don't want to live like this. I don't want to be someone who goes through all of this. I was not acutely suicidal in the way that many of the people I interviewed for The Noonday Demon were, but I did have a period of great self-destructiveness when I felt I didn't really want to go on living, and I engaged in a lot of foolish and risk-taking activities. The one that I've written about in the book is that I sought out a lot of unsafe sexual encounters, and I had the idea somehow that if I were infected with HIV, that would give me an excuse for killing myself, which was something that I decided I wanted to do. It was a phase that didn't last very long, and it passed, and I, in the end, hadn't contracted HIV, and I never made an actual suicide attempt of any kind or of any meaning.
One of the points that comes through your book is the absolute importance of getting help, whether it's through drugs or talk therapy or both, because if you don't do anything about serious depression, it's just going to get worse.
Well, I certainly very much believe in getting both kinds of help if one possibly can. The stories that were actually most stirring and in a way most distressing to me as I talked to so many people who were depressed were not even the stories of people who had not got any kind of help. It's people who don't look for enough help or who don't manage to find good help. I think there are an enormous number of kinds of help that are available. I think there are an enormous number of kinds of treatment. And I met so many people who said to me, well, I tried antidepressants and I took this drug for a while and it didn't really help me. And so I just decided the drugs weren't going to help. And I said, well, you know, half of people who try antidepressants don't have results on their first antidepressant, but two-thirds of those people will have results from their second or third antidepressant that they try.
And there is this assumption that if you just take a drug like Prozac, if it gives you enough serotonin, then you're going to get better. That is the magic bullet. But obviously, that's not the case.
No. I mean, Prozac is a wonderful drug, and for some people, it works miraculously well. But it's important, if it doesn't work miraculously well for you, to keep trying other drugs and trying other lines of treatment. And I think almost all depression, there are a few cases that aren't, but almost all depression is treatable. And almost everyone who has depression can get through it and can recover from it. And I think the great thing is to have the patience and the forbearance to keep trying and to keep battling against it.
How many medications do you take right now?
I currently take five.
Yes.
I take one, which is my primary antidepressant, which is Effexor. And then the others are really primarily to offset side effects. Effexor has the famous negative effects on libido. I take Wellbutrin, which offsets the libido effects. I take Zyprexa, which I take because it lowers anxiety, which I tend to have as a side effect of depression. I take Topamax because the Zyprexa causes weight gain, and a low dose of Topamax, which is really a mood stabilizer, but it prevents the weight gain associated with Zyprexa. And then I take Buspar because I was started on it many years ago, and I don't really think it's doing anything, but it doesn't have any side effects, and I've been taking it for a long time, and I don't really want to monkey around with anything because at the moment I'm feeling right as rain, and I don't seem to have side effects from anything I'm taking. So I've just left it all sort of there as a balance.
You were describing a terrible disease. I mean, the bad cases of depression are truly awful. But you also write that you have learned from this illness, that in some ways it's made your life richer. Can you explain how?
Yes. I feel like that's one of, so far as I'm concerned, the essential messages of The Noonday Demon. And it's one that I didn't anticipate when I set out to write the book. I think depression is a terrible, horrible, bleak, barren experience. And certainly, if you can possibly avoid it in any way, avoid it. But if you've had to go through a depression, there are many rich things to take out of it. I think people who have been through depression are frequently more compassionate than other people simply because they know the extent of pain that is possible. I think people who have been through depression have got a sense of the joyfulness of everyday life because they have such a sense of how wrong things can be. And so simply the fact that they wake up and that they feel like getting out of bed and eating breakfast and getting on with their day suddenly feels revelatory and exciting and splendid. I think people who have had depression are more kind frequently to other people than they would have been. And I think that it can intensify the way in which they love other people. And so I think one takes away a great deal from it. One comes out older but wiser.
Steve Paulson talked with writer Andrew Solomon about his book, The Noonday Demon, An Atlas of Depression.
They call it Stormy Monday, but Tuesday's just as bad. They call it Stormy Monday, but Tuesday's just as bad. Wednesday's worse, and Thursday's also sad.
Coming up, scientists get in touch with our feelings. I'm Jim Fleming. It's To the Best of Our Knowledge from PRI, Public Radio International. Why are some people cheerful and others down? It's a question emotion researchers are probing with the help of new brain imaging technology. Turns out that people who favor the left side of the prefrontal cortex, the part behind your forehead, tend to be happy and optimistic, while people with more activity on the right side tend to be more sad and pessimistic. Well, at least that's what psychiatrist Ned Kalin and psychologist Richard Davidson have found. They explain to N-Strain Champs why the left and right sides of the brain are associated with different emotions. Richard Davidson.
When babies develop and they begin to speak, they first speak in single words. And we know that speech is controlled by the left hemisphere of the brain. When babies begin to say words, they will often point to the objects that they're naming. Or they'll ask, what's that? And they'll point to an object. They typically point with the right hand, which is controlled by the left hemisphere of the brain. So they'll say the word, which we know is controlled by the left hemisphere of the brain in most people. They'll point with the right hand, and they'll also reach toward the object and exhibit a frank sign of what we call approach behavior. They're interested in the object. They often smile. It's part of a whole package that we have associated with what we call approach-related positive emotion. And what that simply means is the kind of positive emotion that a person expresses as they get closer to things that interest them in mm-hmm. their environment.
So are you discovering that people are, to a certain extent, hardwired to experience, hardwired is probably the wrong term, but are you discovering that people are, their brains are set up to tend them to be either happy and positive and cheerful, or they tend more to be depressive and negative and pessimistic?
Well, again, I think we know from knowing our family members and our friends that each of us has a very different kind of emotional makeup. And all of us sort of know, too, that regardless of the events that occur, sooner or later we come back to that baseline state. Some people are more cheerful, some people are more negative, and so on. It's not that we're not affected by environment, but we sort of have a place that we come back to from the standpoint of a baseline. And I think it's reasonable to assume that we also have brain systems that sort of come back to functioning in a way that support those types of emotional styles. So, for example, in the human work that Richie's been involved with, he can demonstrate that he can measure the brain activity in individuals, and that will predict over time how they're going to behave emotionally, and that stays fairly stable within individuals.
How early can you see it? I mean, could you, if you wired up a 3-year-old or even a 3-month-old, could you already see the basic brain pattern?
Well, that's a very important question, and we've done those kinds of studies, and the answer is yes, you can see these differences very early on in life. However, they only become stable after around puberty. Prior to that point, a 3-year-old might be tested, for example, and that 3-year-old may show a certain pattern, and when we test that 3-year-old 3 or 4 years later, he or she may not show the same pattern.
So that suggests that environment and that the early years are as crucially important as we've thought.
Getting back to the question that you asked about being hardwired, I think the answer is yes, that in part it's hardwired, but also these systems can be quite malleable as well. And I think one of the things that's most exciting to us is thinking about not only why is it that someone has a certain emotional style and what's the brain system, but what can be done ultimately to make some changes. Can we actually change the pattern of someone's brain activity in a way that is stable over time and puts them on a different type of trajectory from the standpoint of their emotions or affect, so that, you know, you could imagine that someone that is chronically and habitually feeling somewhat down and pessimistic, is there the potential to come up with new ways to help them not only change their outlook, but also to change perhaps the underlying structure and function of certain brain systems that are very involved in mediating all this? And I think the answer is that there's a lot of belief and hope that that could be the case.
Does that mean if you can catch somebody who's likely to be more depressive, more pessimistic, early on before puberty, you have a better chance of freeing that person, say, from depression for life?
Potentially. And so that's certainly a hope that is raised by current research. Another point to make about this general issue is that we have not, in this culture, I think, given the training of the mind and emotions in particular, a very fair shot, so to speak. We all know that if you practice an instrument for an hour or two a day, you'll show dramatic improvement. Most people will over a cumulative period of time, over, say, a decade. And in fact, studies have been now done showing that there is reorganization of the brain, changes in the brain that can be rigorously demonstrated that accompany musical training.
So what are the kinds of mind training that might be able to affect people's mental states?
Well, I think that there are a whole range of possibilities. We know, for example, that in the area of depression, there are well-known therapeutic techniques which have been available, like cognitive therapy, which have been found to produce beneficial changes in at least a certain percentage of patients who undergo that kind of training. And so if something bad happens to a person, rather than attributing it to themselves and coming to the conclusion that they're a bad person who may be incapable of doing well in that situation, to reinterpret the situation as something that's more situational or more transitory, and not something that is a product of some flaw in themselves.
What do you actually do with the... if you're looking at people, you mentioned the new tools and the new brain imaging techniques. Give me an example of some of the studies that you've done that have been really interesting.
We've completed an imaging study looking at how antidepressants work. And what we do is we image people's brain function before early on in treatment and later on in treatment. And one of the fascinating findings is that we can see changes in the brain that occur with successful treatment. Mm-hmm. And some of those changes actually predict or are correlated with the behavioral change. People that get a lot better have a bigger change in the amygdala, in its reducing its activity, for example. So we're beginning to correlate some of those things.
And the other thing we've learned in that study is there are features of brain activity that we can determine from a person before we begin treatment that actually predicts the extent to which the treatment will work.
But that's amazing, because right now, depressed patients can spend years tinkering around with drugs,
right,
with their patients trying to get something that's just right.
It does have the potential to be an amazing finding. And one of the brain regions that Richie is talking about is a region in the cortex called the cingulate cortex. And the finding is that people that tend to have higher activity in that brain region prior to treatment tend to do better with the antidepressant treatment. And so you can imagine, in the future, and this is science fiction, but it's exciting science fiction, that we would begin to develop some very good predictors of which treatment is going to work for which person, how likely it is that they're going to respond.
So how would it work to play out the science fiction version? How might it work in the future if a depressed patient comes to see you?
I don't think it's unreasonable to think in 5 to 10 years that some of the techniques that we're exploring now could be used to actually sort of do a brain function stress test in somebody. just as you go to the doctor to get a stress test for your heart. And what we would do is we'd put someone in the scanner, as we do now, and we would give them emotional challenges, which is what we do now. Mm-hmm. So give them something that makes them feel negative and look to see how that part of the brain activates. And based on what we've learned, we should be able to predict maybe that this person will do really well with this kind of treatment and this person won't.
If you're, you know, if in this scientific vision, some science future vision, you know, we could get to the point of being able to predict what might help people, would you also wind up prescribing to some people meditation or some other kind of mental training they could do?
Yes, I think quite possibly. And one of the, I think, important questions that our current research is addressing is which treatments might be most effective for which kinds of people. Mm-hmm. And so based upon particular configurations of brain activity, we may be able to determine whether meditation or cognitive therapy or antidepressant medication might be more effective for that kind of person. I think it's very clear that there is no single treatment that is going to be efficacious for all individuals. But we really have not had a rational way of assigning particular individuals to particular types of treatment. And so one of the byproducts of the research that we're doing, I think, will be a much more well-developed specification of which individuals might be most benefited by which kinds of treatment.
Psychologist Richard Davidson and psychiatrist Ned Kalin are scientists at the University of Wisconsin-Madison.
Is it peace or is it Prozac? I don't care. No need to know that. When the moon is full and the world's too close, I just keep my smile and I up my dose. And is it peace or is it Prozac? Is this mellow? Am I a maniac? Is my mind out there? And can I get it back? Is it peace I feel? Or is it Prozac?
If your checking account is in the red, you may want to skip this next report. Economists at the University of Warwick in England have discovered money can buy happiness. They've even calculated the price, and it's steep. Andrew Oswald explained the findings to a very surprised Steve Paulson.
If you follow people through time and observe them before and after financial windfalls, you can see that a windfall of cash generates an enormous amount of happiness and a great boost to your psychological health. So money very clearly does buy happiness.
So what is the price of happiness? How much money are we talking about?
From our results on British individuals, it looks like you need about $1.5 million as a lump sum to move you from being really quite unhappy up to the top end of the happiness distribution, in other words, to being very happy indeed. About $1.5 million will do the trick.
So $500,000 won't get you very far.
Well, it'll move you halfway, and that's certainly worth having. You should bear in mind, too, that, of course, most individuals are not right at the bottom of the spread of happiness to begin with. So if you begin as a fairly cheery individual, maybe half that sum would push you right up to the top.
So you're talking about a major inheritance or winning the lottery, something like that.
We focus, this is a good scientific basis for drawing judgments, on exactly those two things. We study lottery winners through time, before and after, and we study those who get inheritances, sometimes really quite large inheritances of cash. Averaging across these individuals, obviously human beings differ, we can measure the average psychological well-being benefit from every, let's say, $1,000 that you get.
How do you measure this?
We do all sorts of things. One is to ask people on a happiness scale how happy they feel with their life. Another is to take a more medical approach and measure their stress level. To do that, we ask them things about how well they're sleeping, whether they've been feeling under pressure recently. And whichever approach we use, measuring their happiness or their mental stress, we find very strong effects from getting cash.
So have you figured out why more money makes people happier?
Well, our best guess that it gives you more freedom in life. All of my work, I suppose I've been studying this kind of thing for a decade now, suggests that everything to do with human autonomy, allowing people control over their lives and their environment, is what gives a lot of psychological well-being, perhaps just as you would expect. And let's face it, if you get richer, then you have more control, usually, over your life.
So this is interesting because I've heard that people who win the lottery often after, a year or so, they start feeling miserable, that there's almost a set point of happiness, that no matter how much money you have, you're not really, I mean, unless you're at the bottom, the money isn't really going to make you happier. You're saying you're really disproving that.
We are disproving that. This is probably one of the most accurate, most reliable scientific experiments looking at the relationship between money and well-being. Because we track many, many thousands of people and families through time, we see them before they get the cash, we see them afterwards. Of course, they don't know that we're following their well-being responses to those survey questions that we're getting from them. I think this is reliable evidence money does buy happiness.
Is there a limit to how much happiness money can buy? If you make more money, does that make you happier?
In our data, we can't find the limit. Now, of course, you can guess that we have very few people who make multi-millions, say, through winning the lottery, so we're short of data points in the jargon, way up at that end of the income distribution. Therefore, I can't be absolutely certain, but within the numbers that we see, the financial windfalls that we see, there appears to be no limit. That is, every extra $100,000 I get does create a little bit of extra happiness.
And yet I would think that the richest people around, say the CEOs of major corporations, they're not kicking back on their yachts. They're probably working insane hours. There's probably a lot of stress there, and they must enjoy it, otherwise they wouldn't do it. But they're the richest ones around. Is that to say that they're necessarily the happiest?
No, it doesn't. Of course, our results find that lots of things mold human well-being. Happiness is shaped by all sorts of things, and money is just one of those. A tremendously important effect comes from being married, for example. Probably that's the single most important influence on the average person's psychological health, whether or not you've got a long-standing partner. And by tracing many hundreds of thousands of Americans, for example, we can and have calculated the psychological value of marriage, and we put a dollar value on that. A lasting marriage is worth, in our numbers, about $100,000 a year. So if you haven't invested in a partner, that I advise you to do that.
So if people get divorced, they basically need to find $100,000 to make them as happy as they were before.
That's for an average person. Of course, human beings differ, but that's true for an average person. We find that, just as you would expect, when you break up with your partner, there's a huge decline in your psychological well-being and your happiness scores drop off a lot. You might be divorced for a year or two, and then when you find somebody new, your happiness levels and your psychological well-being levels jump right back up.
Can you generalize and say that people who are, upper middle class, even middle class, are on the whole happier than working class people? Or are those generalizations dangerous?
They may be dangerous, but certainly from our data they're true. There's a strong income effect. There's a strong money effect, as we've been discussing. On top of that, regardless of your income, a high level of education seems to buy greater happiness and psychological health in itself. That is, regardless of how much money people earn, if you have a college degree, then you mark yourself much higher on our happiness score sheets, and you mark yourself much higher on our psychological health surveys. We don't know why that is, but again, it probably goes back to freedom, autonomy, being able to mold your own life.
Andrew Oswald is an economist at the University of Warwick in England. He talked with Steve Paulson. Coming up, the feeling of elevation, why good acts can bring us to tears. And if you think real men don't cry, how about these weeping warriors?
When Roland dies, we're told in the Song of Roland, a medieval French epic, that 20,000 knights wept until they fainted and fell off their horses.
I'm Jim Fleming. It's To the Best of Our Knowledge from PRI, Public Radio International. Thank you. Have you ever felt your heart swell up when you see pictures of Mother Teresa feeding hungry children? Or gotten the chills listening to a Martin Luther King speech? That is the feeling of elevation. And up until now, scientists have overlooked it, opting instead to study the more common emotions like anger, joy, fear, and surprise. But psychologist Jonathan Haidt is high on elevation. He's discovering why we're moved by simple acts of kindness.
Elevation is elicited by perceiving moral beauty. That is, we see someone else do something that is good, beautiful, virtuous, above and beyond the call of duty. It feels like, well, it has a variety, people will often describe it in various ways, but the most consistent way that it feels is a warm, open, or glowing feeling in the chest. Sometimes people say they get choked up or they feel chills or tingles, but the chest, and really the heart, it appears to be the central place where you feel something. And then the most characteristic component of all is that elevation seems to make people want to be better people themselves and do good deeds for others. That's why I think it's so important for the study of morality.
Can you give me an example of a situation that would likely create the feeling of elevation in someone?
Sure, I can tell you one of the most powerful feelings that I had myself was, I remember when Nelson Mandela came out of prison, and everyone was wondering, what will this guy even look like? Nobody'd seen him for so long, and he came out. And if anybody had a right to be full of hatred, it was him. But when he came out and preached forgiveness and reconciliation and said we must all work together, that was so thrilling. I'm actually getting a little bit of chills right now just sitting here remembering that moment. So any kind of display of say, forgiveness, charity, kindness, all these things that make us start thinking that somebody is a saint or a god. So simple acts of kindness that people do, acts of loving tenderness, anything like that.
One of the things that I thought was interesting was you said even describing that situation now, that memory, you began to feel again elevated. It sounds as though this feeling of elevation is one that has long-lasting effects.
That remains to be seen. My guess is, if I had to guess right now, it would be that little waves of elevation, like I just had, have very short effects. Probably 10 minutes from now, there's no measurable effect of any sort. But I think that, and this is, again, speculation, but I think that when people have very powerful effects, when some threshold is reached, and especially if there's some social support for the change, I think people can have profound and potentially life-altering changes. So if you look at the biographies or stories about Jesus or Buddha or Mother Teresa or any other such figure, you find that people who encounter them are often so moved and have such a powerful emotional experience at the time that they're willing to drop everything, get rid of, sell all their previous possessions, even change their name, and devote themselves to spreading the word or doing good works or just in any way helping the person who elicited that feeling. So I think it can cause a kind of a conversion experience, in fact.
This raises the question of where this came from, I guess. It seems like most of the emotions that we recognize can be identified as having some practical purpose in the past. Fear makes, if you see something that is dangerous to you, then you run. I mean, there's an obvious benefit to that. Is there, can you see an evolutionary purpose for elevation?
We believe that the evolutionary precursor here is awe in a hierarchical interaction. So if you look at primate interactions, there's very clear dominance and submissiveness. Being in the presence of a very powerful leader has certain effects, emotional effects. And when you look at the original meaning of awe, it's mixed with terror or fear. Awe always has tremendous fear associated with it. So we think that the human mind was shaped, as were other primate minds, for hierarchical interactions and to feel a sense of awe and reverence for great leaders, for those that we look up to. In modern times, this is hard for us to see because we have so few truly hierarchical interactions. We don't generally really respect our bosses or certainly not look up to them as gods. But in a feudal system or in earlier times when people did have a lot of hierarchical interactions, I think it would have been a little clearer.
Most of the time when we feel what you call elevation, it's due to the actions of someone like Mother Teresa that make us feel like we are better human beings if we follow the example set by someone like that.
In one study, the question was, please describe a situation where you saw a manifestation of humanity's higher or better nature. I left it very abstract like that. And we got a couple of stories about things like Mother Teresa, but most of them were about just friends of the family or strangers they saw on the street. So most of it's pretty mundane, simple stuff. You know, somebody helping somebody else with their groceries or returning a lost wallet or helping a child or an animal. It's usually actually very simple acts of kindness like that.
So it's important to study elevation. What do you expect to learn from it?
Well, there are a number of things. First is just a basic portrait of the human being, of human nature. We have gotten our ideas of human nature from a variety of sources, some of which I think have given us a distorted picture. And in 20th century social science, the general idea was people are basically selfish and greedy. And we can explain everything by positing that people are just out to get as much as they can. And, you know, they follow laws and they help each other if it's in their interest, et cetera. I think that's just completely wrong. I think that human nature is very complex. We are capable of doing horrible and brutal things, but I think a big part of human nature are things like gratitude, love, a desire to have a good reputation, a desire to be a good person. And it's important to include elevation just as a part of our understanding of human nature. I think it's a really beautiful fact about our Constitution that we can be moved to tears by the sight of a stranger doing a good deed for another stranger when there's nothing in it for us.
Jonathan Haidt teaches psychology at the University of Virginia. For most people, it's not hard to get the waterworks flowing. A sappy melodrama, a bad breakup, a skinned knee, a wedding ceremony. But just why do we cry anyway? Tom Lutz has written a natural history of weeping. Turns out that human beings are great big crybabies.
One of the explanations for why human beings are the only species that cry is because we're the species that discovered fire. And as cavemen with campfires going in the caves, the people who developed the largest lacrimal ducts managed to save their eyes and survive.
So there's no question humans are the only species that cries.
Yes. I mean, I probably shouldn't say there's no question. There are people who argue that elephants, for instance, weep. The problem is that when in distress, animals will squeeze their eyes when they're in great pain, and squeezing eyes can cause a flow of tears over the eyelid that would otherwise drain. So,
which is different somehow from crying. And I guess maybe we need a definition then. I mean, if you say it's because we invented fire, if the equipment is there, And smoke gets in your eyes and you start to cry, I mean, that could happen to other animals as well, right?
Yes, and those are called irritant tears, right? So if a foreign object gets in your eye or you get poked in the eye, or onions, for instance, are the famous case, irritant tears are produced that lubricate the eye and get the foreign object out. Emotional tears are different. They are actually chemically different. Emotional tears have different levels of hormones and different levels of salts and other substances in them.
I mean, there are so many different things that make people cry. Some people cry out of anger. Some people cry out of fear. Some people cry because they're happy. Or some mm-hmm. people cry just because.
Yes. And undoubtedly, some of that is very, very personal. That is how a person is brought up. For instance, we know that in some cultures, two-year-olds cry more than they do in other cultures. We know in some cultures, six-year-olds cry more than they do in other cultures. And that's related to the child-rearing techniques in those cultures. If an infant is immediately comforted and immediately gratified when it cries, it's going to cry more often than an infant that doesn't. An infant that's completely neglected stops crying altogether. So everybody, of course, has slightly different parenting history, has a slightly different, you know, is made fun of in school for crying more or less. People have developed different habits within cultures as well as among them.
In your study of different cultures, have there been times at which it was more approved of to cry?
Definitely. In the 18th century, crying was a sign of your great refinement. And so if you were a theater goer and you didn't weep at the theater, it showed that you were kind of a heartless cad. And so people wept profusely at the theater. Certainly, warrior tears that I talk about, medieval warrior epics in which warriors were all profuse weepers. And when Roland dies, we're told in the Song of Roland, a medieval French epic, that 20,000 knights wept until they fainted and fell off their horses, which is a kind of Monty Python-esque scene, I think. But a certain amount of exaggeration, undoubtedly, in there, literary exaggeration. But it shows that crying was accepted in a way in the army that it wouldn't be today.
Well, I was just going to say, one of the things that we hear, and it's not just the modern army, is tough guys don't cry, you know?
Mm-hmm.
In 20th century America, you would be less of a man, it seems to me, if you were to weep on the battlefield.
Yes, and this idea of male stoicism, I mean, there are ideals of male stoicism since the Greeks, at least, but they take very, very different forms. And the most recent one, that is the one that really begins in the 1890s in America and runs through to today to a certain extent, of that men don't cry, is, number one, false. And number two is only about certain kinds of weeping. When General Schwarzkopf was interviewed on Barbara Walters, he cried, as all of her guests do. And she said, well, generals don't cry. And he said, well, yes, they do. Lee cried, Sherman cried, Lincoln cried, all the great generals cried at different times. And I have cried, he said, at Christmas services for the troops. I wouldn't cry in front of them when I was giving them battle orders. I wouldn't cry when I was fulfilling my role as a general. But when I'm fulfilling my role as the kind of father figure for the troops at a Christmas service, then it's appropriate for me to cry. And men continued to weep through the whole 20th century ban on crying.
Is there any suggestion that there is an emotional loss if you are trained out of crying?
Well, I think that we now certainly have that view. That is, that if you can't cry, you don't have the full range of human emotional response, and that it's therefore a kind of handicap or a disability of some kind. The idea that was important in the therapies of the 1970s, for instance, that you needed to cry in order to free up repressed emotions, and that crying was necessary to emotional health, I think is not in fact true. But we do have a sense, we definitely have a sense that we need to be able to cry because it's a basic form of human expression. And so why not?
Can you give me an example of a culture that has very specific rules for crying?
All cultures have fairly specific rules for crying. I mean, they're not conscious. That is, we learn them on the fly, and not everybody learns them as well as other people. But we all know that not to cry on the bus unless we want to be thought in complete distress. So we may read a particularly moving passage in a book that could, for instance, get us to weep in private, but we will control it in public, in a public place like on a subway. Now, some cultures, for instance, in Korean culture, mourning has very, very elaborate rituals that have been codified. So there are books about when exactly you're supposed to cry, in which place, wearing which kinds of clothes, on which day of the very, very long and protracted and elaborate funeral rituals.
Let's look at the other side of that equation, if you will. What is it about two hanky movies that is so pleasing to people? Why do we go to these things? I mean, Titanic is an example of a movie mm-hmm. recently that produced an awful lot of wet hankies on the way out of the theater, and people loved it.
Yeah, now, and two hanky, that's a kind of not a great one, because of the four hanky is the one I keep hearing, but the four hanky job. But the very earliest mention of crying that I found was a 14th century B.C., fragment of a clay tablet. It was the story of the death of Baal, the earth god. This is from pre-Hebrew Canaan. And the virgin goddess Anat, when she sees her brother Baal dead, starts to weep, and the fragment reads, "She continued sating herself with tears, drinking of them like wine." So the very earliest representation of tears we have in human history is a representation of tears as a kind of auto-intoxicant, as something that can sate a person, as something that's somehow pleasurable, even in extreme distress. And many different cultures and Western culture at many different times has been very aware of that, of the pure pleasure of tears. I think that some of that has to do with the simple fact that when you're crying, you can be so overwhelmed with the sensations of your own body that other cognition largely ceases, that you can stop thinking about it. It's a pure kind of escape into bodily sensation.
Tom Lutz is the author of Crying, The Natural and Cultural History of Tears. He teaches at the University of Iowa.
Cry me a river, I cried a river over you.
It's To the Best of Our Knowledge. I'm Jim Fleming. If you want a cassette copy of this hour, please call the radio store at 1-800-747-7444 and ask for the program Nothing More Than Feelings, number 71B. You can write to us at, To the Best of Our Knowledge, Wisconsin Public Radio, 821 University Avenue, Madison, Wisconsin, 53706, or email us through our web address, www.wpr.org/book. It's always nice to hear from you.
PRI, Public Radio International.